The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The meaning of movies this hour, escapist entertainment or statements about culture we can never escape. The Syrian refugee crisis and the bloody war in Syria and Iraq become cues for a documentarian's cameras to roll. Filmmaker activists claim watching some movies is a form of protest. And on this program, a Syrian refugee publicly announces he wants presidential candidate Donald Trump to come to his house for dinner to see that his life is normal. Mr. Trump, are you listening? There's a movie I'd love to see. And is not going to the movies a form of protest? We begin this hour reacting to the absence of African-American Oscar nominations in a year with plenty of more than credible candidates. The omission was egregious enough for Spike Lee and actress Jada Pinkett Smith to call for a boycott of the ceremony this year. Pinkett Smith posted an angry video to Facebook you've probably heard.
Maybe it is time that we pull back our resources and we put them back into our communities, into our programs, and we make programs for ourselves.
What might that accomplish? Here to react to the boycott and everything else is director of the documentary Free Angela and All Political Prisoners, Shala Lynch, filmmaker and curator at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, and author and poet Paul Beatty, author of the 2015 novel The Sellout. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hi.
So what do you make of, first of all, when the nominations come out, do you count? Do you note the composition of the nominees and react and then wait for people like Spike to engage in a larger conversation and, you know, wonder what's going to happen? What was your reaction?
I do look and I scan down. And the thing about this year that is interesting, last year it was one big movie, right? So either Selma was going to be nominated, people from Selma were going to be nominated. This year there were a number of independent films. And if you go down the list of people who potentially in all the categories could have been nominated, it's about 20, 25 people and not one was. I mean, the Academy is an institution, and I think we have to think of it that way. So individual people vote, yes, and that's how they think. Oh, this is my favorite performance, et cetera. But as an institution, it hasn't really recognized black stories. It's recognized black talent for sure. Absolutely. There have been a lot of people who have been recognized for individual performances, but it doesn't change the landscape of stories and which stories are considered highbrow and acceptable within that realm.
Paul?
Yes.
Do you think...
I don't think they recognize much things that aren't white, specifically black, I guess, in this case, other than the tuxedos. I think that's about it.
This is an old story.
I've seen this movie already, you know.
and that's Spike Lee's point. He's like, why am I going to go up and protest? It is an old story. But when you're a maker, there is the kind of double consciousness of it. You don't make films to be accepted by the Academy, but wouldn't it be awesome to be accepted by the Academy? And there is a moment of disappointment because we do want recognition for our work, period. But that's not always the place for it.
I guess there's a tension between, you know, the Hollywood is the place to get jobs and make money if you're a screenwriter, if you're a person who has a book that you would love to get optioned. That's a different process than being recognized by the Academy. How do you think of that?
You know, I think, you know, all artists want to be appreciated and recognized. And there's this weird kind of, I don't know, you kind of alluded it to it earlier, Charlotte, about this double consciousness that they have, you know, that you kind of want to get patted on the back by the person that you really don't have any respect for. At least you claim not to, you know, on a certain level. And so, you know, it's a weird situation, you know. The thing that I've been appreciative of is that 12 Years a Slave one, you know, which was just a challenging movie on any number of levels. And I was just happy to see it. Whether I thought it deserved to win or anything, I was just that was something that really stuck with me because it was just one of those things. I think, you know, like there's this – I think one of the problems I have with some of the discussion, mostly, you know, comments on Twitter or whatever, is this kind of assumption that, you know, whatever, you know, the white nominees are, that it's just automatically merited, where none of it's merited, you know? This is just the people who get picked.
That's true. None of it is merited. And people will say, well, there's been certain folks that haven't been recognized by the Academy, but in their racial category, there have been other folks that have been recognized. So when somebody is essentially excluded in many ways, then that's problematic. Who's our Meryl Streep? Oh, we don't have one? We're not talented enough to have somebody who's nominated every year? Although we have a couple of guys in town who are nominated quite a bit, right, behind the scenes. And so if the Academy reflects our media and our movies, American movies, and is not reflecting the diversity of our culture, you know, you have to ask a question. So when I say it's an institutional issue, it is. That said, as a maker, we do it independently. You know what I mean? Nobody gives me permission to make the films that I'm trying to make. Nobody gives you permission to write the books that you're trying to make. And I would submit 12 Years a Slave, an independent film, Fruitvale Station, an independent film, Selma, an independent film. And when they blow up in the marketplace, then Hollywood begins to embrace them. But Hollywood is not generating these stories and this diversity.
Yeah, I have this thing, I don't know, this issue of like these institutions are supposed to be reflective of American culture. You know, America is reflective of itself, or however you see that, you know. And so just the room on the bookshelf for the individual stories is the important, because that's where it is. And, you know, there's the work on the viewer, too, to get this stuff out there. And it's if you need this for your affirmation, you know, and I understand like how important it is and all that. But it says something about you also, and it just says something about how we see ourselves as artists, you know. And I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not trying to make a judgment on it, you know, because, look, if I was a filmmaker, I'd want to be recognized. I mean, it can change your life, you know. And so I understand all that.
And you are an author who has been recognized within the literary establishment.
Yeah, I mean,
so
that's why
if
I'm
you're at the
here.
Top of your game as an actor and you're not being recognized by the institution that says, you know, everybody has an equal chance, there is a bit of disappointment.
So let me say this, though.
You choose to be in an independent space, which is
so. Let's take this thing. I had to get this one thing out because so, like the best performance I've seen haven't seen a ton of movies was this kid Jason Mitchell who's in Straight Outta Compton, and I haven't heard a single person talk about how fantastic he is in this role because he's playing himself. Or I don't know how people see this whole thing, you know. And so it's interesting about, like, you know, even a generational thing that it's Spike, Will Smith, these other two people who within the context, you know, relatively are, you're not going to get any better than that, you know? You know, and it's interesting, though, because this is a kid who, however I feel about that movie, he was so good in this. And I just was so pissed that I haven't heard his name mentioned,
and,
you know?
That's a situation where you want art to find that kind of a voice and that kind of a performance and that kind of freshness. And then you want that to be recognized, not even so much for a racism narrative, but as a kind of like, that's what art is supposed to be. And the Academy misses that as much as it misses the whole film Straight Outta Compton.
Everything misses that. So, Charlotte, let me ask you this. If you're in the position to go to the Oscars, would you go?
If I was nominated?
Yeah. Or you had an invitation. I don't know who gets to go to this thing.
Would you go? No.
Wouldn't go?
Just to be there? Probably not. I think that, like going to Sundance, you want to go with your film. That there is something, when you are being recognized with your work, you've been part of a project, and it's that's the fun of it. I mean, I don't think awards are just fun to go.
So if you had a film that was up, you would go or you wouldn't go?
This year,
yeah.
That's a really good question. I would have to, because the other part of it is, you know, we have Cheryl, who is head of the Academy, and Reggie Hudlin, who is producing the Academy right. Awards this year. That is huge. That's and the first right there.
Chris Rock.
And Chris, well, and Reggie brings in Chris.
Right.
So it's unfortunate. I would have to seriously think about it. I actually would take the Michael Moore approach.
Which is, what's his approach?
His approach is, if you get the mic, you take it, and it's an opportunity to speak to the world. You know, that's what's amazing is that you don't get a bigger platform. So many people watch that show. I mean, and so I would take the Michael Moore approach, cross my fingers to win, right?
Marlon Brando approach.
Yes, the Marlon Brando approach. Yeah. Absolutely.
Shala and Paul, thanks so much.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Shala Lynch is a filmmaker and curator at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem. And Paul Beatty is author and poet. His most recent novel is called The Sellout. It was a chilly afternoon on an official humanitarian mission in Lower Manhattan at the Xavier Mission on 15th Street. The usual, this busy community kitchen feeds the hungry by the hundreds each week. There are clothing donations to sort, a shelter for men, and caring for the occasional injured person.
So someone has a boo-boo.
I hurt myself in soccer.
That's 3-year-old Rian, one of the children volunteering along with adults and some refugees from the Middle East and South Asia, volunteering to clean and scrub this vast dining hall.
How come she gets
an apron? A good question. He wants to know why she gets an apron and can help clean and he can't.
I think you can have an apron.
You want an apron?
No.
Rian and her older brother Declan are having a dispute that some impromptu diplomacy only partly resolves. The diplomat here is also their mom, and she's used to dealing with recalcitrant Russians and irate Iranians. But on this Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, is trying to give her kids a lesson in what it's like outside the Obama administration power matrix.
For an Irish immigrant to be living in the Waldorf Astoria is, you know, I had trouble getting used to it. My kids did not.
Yeah. Isn't that funny how that works?
Yeah. I'm trying more and more to bring them into a little bit
more
of what's actually happening in the real world.
Samantha Power, Rian, and Declan, welcome to the real world.
Hi, my name's Andy.
Hi, good to meet you, Andy.
Good to meet
Samantha.
You. So you and your crew,
we're
going to have you helping cleaning up here. I don't know how much you've been told already. Right. This hall is used for the St. Francis Xavier Meal Service every Sunday for about 33 years. So yesterday we served 1,506 meals.
Wow.
Andy Lippman from the Coalition Against Hunger hands out bottles of bluish glass cleaner, and the ambassador and her young staff get to work scrubbing.
Hey, look down here. See the dirt? We need you to wash that off. Can you go a little harder with your little hand? Bravo.
I can do it.
You can do it without your mom. Wait, Deck, you're going to need to get a paper towel. I think it's from a sticker that was stuck on there a long time ago.
I'm going to clean up the top.
Okay, see the dirt right here? This is what you want to get off. But wait, here's a little spray. There you go.
This is fun. I can see my reflection in it now.
The symbolism of this team of workers goes considerably beyond simple fun, though. Among the volunteers are several refugees from Syria, including some young doctors. They were not comfortable giving us their names because they have families still in war-torn Syria, but they feel very comfortable and welcome here in the United States.
The United States will give me the opportunity to be a good man, a successful doctor, and I will continue to work hard until I achieve my dream.
This doctor's dream is to succeed here in America, to be reunited with his family, far from a nation that would have forced him into the army to face ISIS and other killer insurgents. He just wants peace, and is happy to explain that to anyone, even a Muslim-banning billionaire.
I all invite Donald Trump to come to my house and visit me.
You really are inviting Donald Trump to your house?
Yes, he can. I have one
bedroom.
Be careful.
Be careful what you wish for. He'll come.
Yes, he can come. And they will know that our life is funny. We'll live normal life like all other people.
The humanitarian workers here at the Xavier Mission understand that normal life is the goal of these refugees, not some bloody Islamist utopia. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power believes, despite the rhetoric of campaign headlines, most Americans understand that too.
I think all across the country, my sense is that there are communities stepping up in huge ways. I mean, this has been going on for decades, that families across America are opening their doors, you know, delivering their toys and their hand-me-down clothes and their books to new families who are coming. the stipend that the U.S. government gives is enough to get a family through some number of months, but fundamentally it's the communities that have stepped up that have made it possible for all so many families over the years to get resettled. The challenge is that a lot of what is happening and what families are doing to make refugees feel welcome is not very visible. What's visible are what people say in debates or sound bites. And I know in talking to some number of families who are newly resettled, they're kind of stunned at the rhetoric and hurt by it. So I think our job, in addition to actually reaching out and engaging refugees that are trying to resettle, is also to lift up the examples of communities who are opening their doors in order to offset, you know, some of the noise that is out there.
Is that disconnect part of the bigger theme of your tenure at the United Nations, in the sense that one of the things you've learned in your long career is that sometimes local entities have an enormous amount of power, maybe more power than national governments that you criticized so much in the beginning of your career?
Well, I think a couple things. I mean, public policy is about people. So what I feel a responsibility to do whenever I can is to engage with real individuals who are affected by real policies, and certainly also those affected by rhetoric as well. And it's too easy, I think, to just be out there saying, hey, refugees are welcome, or on the other side, refugees are not welcome. One has to actually get to know these families and these people and listen to them. Pope Francis, I thought, had a very memorable line in his speech before the Congress where he said, see their faces. You know, if they become just numbers, then whether you're inside the Situation Room or you're outside on some stump, you know, trying to whip people's fears, they're just abstractions. And so what's consistent, certainly in my career, is no matter whether I was a journalist or a human rights advocate or now in government, is you just got to go talk to people and hear how they're doing and what they're confronting. And then if you can, do your part to try to make it a little bit easier for them. They've been through enough. I mean, if you're a Syrian and you've come to this country, it's almost guaranteed that you have really close family members who are living under horrific conditions still in Syria. It's almost guaranteed that your story of flight was unimaginable. You know, whether it's dodging bullets or the extreme cold or the worry that you weren't going to be able to feed your kids or the worry that you were going to get kicked out of a neighboring country, every one of the stories that these people have to tell is you know, a reminder of what they've gone through and just how desperate they were to find safe ground and how grateful they are to the United States for having offered that to them.
Finally, because it's unavoidable, are your days number? Are you looking at the end of this really pretty crucial stint in your life story?
Well, I am focused on the fourth quarter of President Obama's fourth quarter, the second half of the fourth quarter now, I guess it is. And we have a lot to do, as I think you heard in the State of the Union. We are only going to get more ambitious as the clock ticks and we head toward January of 2017. Every job I've done in government, I've come in with a list of things to do. And I think Syria is certainly something that stands out as being one of the most horrific situations in the world. And so this being here and meeting people who are from Syria, who have family members in Syria who are themselves donating their time and their service to give back to American communities, it's just another reminder again of our responsibility to them. So that's atop the list of things to do in 2016. I'm not thinking beyond then.
Ambassador Power, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power. She may be settling down after this stint in the Obama cabinet. She says there will be time to reflect on the meaning of her tenure at the UN, but there is still much to do right now. Dealing with North Korea and Cuba, close to the top of her list. Close to the bottom, but undoubtedly a significant challenge, although she didn't mention it, explaining to her 3 and 6-year-olds why they have to move out of the Waldorf Astoria. Our takeaway series looking at the work of America's community colleges continues today with a discussion of how to jump onto the educational ladder when it feels out of reach. Alex Diaz and Luis Rodriguez come from a tough part of town. In their case, it's Boston's Dorchester neighborhood. And they have difficult pasts. Both of them are high school dropouts, former gang members, and convicted felons. Is community college even an option? College-bound Dorchester says yes. It's a volunteer program that targets the toughest youth in this neighborhood, with the goal of preparing its students to take the high school equivalency test and eventually enroll into local community colleges. For Alex Diaz, who served 8 years for armed robbery, part of that path means changing the expectations other people have for him.
A lot of people see you as like, you're not going to go nowhere, you're not going to get a job or even go back to school. I even felt like that at one time for hearing it so much. And I just had to overcome everybody's opinions and everybody's thoughts. And now, you know, I just see myself like, look at me now. You know, I wake up every day, I'm happy, I'm energized, I'm ready to go. And for me to go to college after what I've been through is a big achievement, very big achievement for me and my family, especially my daughter.
Lewis, what's it like to see that community college admission out there in front of you? You're not there yet, but what's it look like?
I could taste it, John. I'm just surrounded by positive academic people, and I'm just so eager just for the next chapter of my life. And it definitely involves academics.
Lewis, 5 years ago, what was the most important thing to you from that place that you described that you've come from now?
As sick as it might sound, 5 years ago, my goals was probably to be the biggest distributor of drugs in Boston. But I found myself in a federal prison and state prison. And like I said, those are not places that I see myself in the future.
Why was drugs the most practical solution for figuring out what you were going to do with your life 5 years ago, Lewis, or more?
For a 10-year-old kid in the city of Boston to acquire heroin or to acquire crack, it's not a difficult task. And when you have people persisting you day and night to supply them with drugs, when you live in these drug neighborhoods, it's a pretty hard road to walk down, especially, you know, like money. And, you know, you got the media always enticing you with purchasing and buying. And like I said, it's just a lot easier to fall in Roxbury and Dorchester than it is in Quincy or Weymouth.
Alex, would you agree with that?
Yes, definitely. It's actually more easy to get drugs on these streets than most likely to get help right now.
How close did either of you come to ending up dead from the kind of gun violence that you get involved with in the drug trade in Boston? And how close did either of you come to maybe being on the other end of the gun, ending someone else's life? Alex?
I've been shot twice, stabbed, and I've been on both sides. You know, it's a wake-up call, you know, and after you probably walked with death and seen death a couple of times, I mean, I hope, you know, it's a wake-up call for certain people. It definitely was for me.
Lewis?
Well, I was shot 10 times, and I've tasted death, I've seen death. You know, I found myself on both sides of the culture, pushing the gun and actually getting pushed on me. That's part of the reason why I'm at College Bound today is, you know, the day that I got shot, they killed the old me and they brought a new me out.
Luis Rodriguez is a staff advisor and mentor for College Bound Dorchester, where Alex Diaz is a student. If community colleges are about realizing the full potential of all students, could they also be about giving students the space to screw up? The man who runs Boston's College Bound Dorchester program brings his own experience to bear. CEO Mark Culleton knows transforming tough neighborhoods is no easy task, but when he sees young men like Alex Diaz and Luis Rodriguez, he sees hope and an understanding of where they come from.
My background, when I was younger, I got into a lot of trouble myself. I got pulled into a police station for breaking and entering, selling drugs. But I came from a family where college was the expectation from a white family, and so I was let go. So I had sort of the privilege of making mistakes, but still having adults around me who believed in me and knew that I could do anything. So I think that if we do the same thing with the young people in the communities of Dorchester and throughout this country, they too can rise and complete college and live a full life.
Permission to make mistakes, that's really key. So Lewis and Alex bring to their success, if they make it, a kind of genius of experience that we need to have in the higher education population, that it shouldn't be all the same kind of person. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. I mean, just because somebody has made mistakes, just because maybe they've been incarcerated or maybe they've dropped out of school, that does not define who they are. And in fact, having young people from the communities of Dorchester or the South Bronx or South Side of Chicago who get into and get through college and are part of our workforce makes us a better community, makes us a stronger economy. It's those types of folks that have overcome adversity and have the grit and resiliency to do that on the streets that could then make it a better economy for the whole country.
How do you know your program is not simple charity, kind of once a year charity, and is more of a sustainable model for really thinking hard about who's not served in higher ed?
We know it by what our students show us every day, every year, that the quote-unquote gangbangers that were out there doing negative things in the streets that are now on college campuses studying or graduating and entering the workforce, that their transformation is a transformation that's possible for any gang member in America, and that they want out, they want, like all of us, to provide for their children, to create a better life. And so if we just give them the opportunity, it's not charity. It's just doing what we would expect anybody to do with our own children.
Mark Culleton is the CEO of College Bound Dorchester. To keep up with all of our community college coverage, please visit thetakeaway.org/communitycollege. You can listen to stories from our featured colleges and find out how your community college ranks on our interactive map. We love the community college stories you've been sharing.
My wife and I went to school at community college in our late 40s. The philosophy of community colleges is that anybody can succeed with enough supports. The philosophy at the universities is separate the wheat from the chaff.
This is Zach Brown from San Diego. As a working adult, community college prepared me well for the four-year experience at San Diego State. I went in with no student loans, and I'm leaving with less than $10,000. I think it's a great way to get ahead and make a difference in your life.
We always want to hear from you, of course. Share your community college story. Tell us anything. Give us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. For the film moguls in Hollywood, movies are about box office, and arguing over the racial composition of award shows is as close to real political activism most filmmakers get at the Oscars. Now, a story of two filmmakers who consider their latest documentary, Salaam Neighbor, a form of political activism itself. Zach Ingrassi and Chris Temple spent a month in the Zaatari refugee camp in Jordan, where 90,000 out of the 1 million refugees Jordan has taken in since the fighting began in Syria in 2011 live. Ghassan is a mother of three young children.
In Syria, I was a nurse. And when I came to Mafraq, I registered with most of the nonprofit organizations. But honestly, the support was not enough. It just covers the daily basics for living.
Ghassan's is just one person's story, but filmmakers Zach and Chris believe that an accumulation of real faces can move people to action and connection.
You see it all over the place. I mean, you see the ways that people are creating their own businesses in the camp. There were over 3,000 businesses that had started in this camp, which is in the middle of the desert, middle of nowhere, and it had developed into a multi-million dollar economy. And I mean, that's not what you expect in a refugee camp. One of the guys we met had created even his own solar power generator. You know, when you can unleash that potential of Syrians, that's when it can benefit the host countries as well, because, you know, many of these Syrians, like Kasun, who was a nurse, she has skills that she can add to whatever country provides her a home. And so
people acquire skills, like the notion of recycling in the camp becomes artful almost.
Yeah, one of our favorite and the most inspiring characters, Uma Lee, who's actually a grandmother who, for the first time in her life, has to support her family, and she becomes the breadwinner, and she does this by recycling old bags in the camp that she finds on the ground into these incredibly beautiful pieces of artwork.
I used to walk in the streets of Zaatari and collect plastic bags from the street. People used to laugh at me, but I continued. I would cut the bags and work with them.
And this is just one of, you know, 1,000 examples of the ingenuity you see in this camp of people starting businesses and different ways to really provide. And in some ways for her, you know, she has found opportunity in crisis.
Who and what relationship did you develop in the camp who conveyed ultimately the level and the depth of sacrifice that these people were experiencing and had experienced to even get to where you were?
So, you know, we met this one young man who actually looked so much like my dad. And I'm, you know, no way Syrian, but we immediately hit it off. He was in Syria studying to become a French teacher. His name was Ismail. And the war totally interrupted his career and his education, and he was forced to flee his future in some ways with his entire family in the middle of the night, do this very dangerous journey to cross the border and kind of try and restart his life in Za'atari camp in Jordan. And in this camp, he actually doesn't have access to university at the moment. And it's something that he has really strongly been advocating for. He actually started a group called the Syrian Youth Committee to help advocate for education and get other kids back into school and hopefully allow people like him to have more opportunities to restart their lives.
And he's among the most passionate about going home.
Every Syrian says they're going to go back and rebuild society. What scares me is if we go back to Syria with an ignorant generation. If we do, we will need at least 10 years to educate them before we can rebuild anything.
Yeah, absolutely. And he believes that right now, if we don't take advantage of the opportunity to get kids back in school, of allowing young men and women to continue with upper, higher level education, university, then we're really losing out on the future of Syria, because these are the people that are going to rebuild the society in the future.
And you can see it in the pictures that the little kids draw in school, the images that convey, as your film does, how day by day, month by month, these kids are losing their life. Who conveyed that to you?
I mean, there was this one little kid, Rauf, who we met on day one. He, you know, we arrived in the camp, we're setting up our tent, and he
explained how to use a toothbrush.
Yeah, exactly. Right. He showed us how to use very simple tools like a toothbrush. So
he gave great advice, really.
He was our informal guide, really, you know, and he showed us where bread distribution was, and he took us around the camp. I mean, this is a massive camp of 80,000 people, and, you know, I think we really connected with him. We saw a lot of ourselves in him. I mean, he was playing video games on his dad's cell phone while we were there, and he wanted to had this dream of becoming a doctor when he, you know, when he grew up. But he just celebrated his third birthday in Za'atari, and his third year without being in school. He's now 11 years old, and you know, he is that population that's so vulnerable that Ismail was talking about. Where
why was he not in school?
So, you know, his situation is, again, very representative of a lot of families coming out of a war zone or out of Syria, where he tried to go to school one day in the camp while we were there, actually. And he goes all the way to the school and he walks right to that classroom door and he just breaks down in the doorway in tears. We found out that his school had been bombed back in Syria. And we had no idea the whole time we were there that this had happened. It was kind of this moment that we realized, although he'd been smiling and so positive, you know, right under the surface was this incredible trauma that holds him back from being able to restart school.
It hit you like a ton of bricks, that moment.
Yeah, oh, man. I mean, that was the moment that really broke us down in the film as well.
Finally, your film begins with news footage, but then about three quarters of the way through the film, you introduce images that were obtained by refugees who go back to take pictures of their homes. Those are devastating images. How did you feel when you first saw them?
Heartbroken is the one first answer. But I mean, really what that shows us, seeing those images in the film of these bombed out buildings, of these really just destroyed streets. I mean, 85% of the infrastructure in Syria is now destroyed. And I think, again, it reiterated to us just people did not have a choice but to be forced out of their country. And I think that is, again, so critical to think about when we're trying to deal with, you know, are we going to welcome, asking this big question, are we going to welcome refugees into our own countries?
Zach and Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Zach and Grassi and Chris Temple are the directors of Salaam Neighbor. The documentary airs on Pivot, a network of participant media, tonight. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. the Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.